Interview. You've been through this before. I think it was my first cycle that you were here for your first round, and yours too, right?
Yeah.
Six years ago.
Yeah.
So you know this process. We're going to turn it back to you for opening comments and remarks about why you're seeking a seat on the Board of Regents. Then we'll ask a number of questions and then turn it back to you for some closing comments, hopefully all within 45 minutes.
All right. I think we can do it.
Well, Regent Omari, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. It was 6 years ago that I was here. Hard to believe.
We're in the other room facing the other direction.
We were. But first and foremost, I would like to say thank you to the members, to the senators, to the representatives. In particular, I point out the RCAC staff as well. Many of you may know that I just was sitting on that side of the table, as you all are, for a somewhat important search recently. I really want to highlight the staff because without the staff, I think we wouldn't be able to do what we do as far as our volunteer role. So thank you to the staff, thank you to the members, and those that are, yes.
Yeah, round of applause.
So I think I'll start with just a few remarks, and then I'll attempt to answer most of the 9 bullets that were asked in the opening statement, and then turn to you all. So, you know, it was mentioned 6 years ago I was here, and while I was a student representative to the Board of Regents for 2 years, I had virtually little idea of what I was actually getting into. You know, I knew the meeting flows, I knew the reading load, I knew how much I would have to prepare and that type of thing. However, the amount of time, topics, impact, and importance of the role were not known at that time. And I think about the folks who are very talented and who are applying and interviewing for this position, and I've reflected on this a bit and thought about what it might look like and what are the types of things that I hope I've brought and that I think are necessary when serving in a role like this. First, I think about an ability to bring one's own experience, knowledge, and values to the table. I think about the necessity to bring those things while also being humble, flexible, and collegial being key to the role of a regent. There needs to be a willingness to learn, a willingness to change one's mind, as long as their core values are not compromised. Admit when one is wrong, and a willingness to not have things go our way, but move forward with one voice and a team effort. Turning to the 9 questions/bullet points that were marked in the opening statement guidelines, let me try to walk through a few of those. Number one, I'll start not with my work life and experience. I'll start with just mentioning that my family, my siblings, my parents, and my nieces and nephews, above all, are the things that guide me, hold me accountable, and the reason why I do the work that I do, the reason why I volunteer, because I look at my nieces and nephews, they call me Uncle Dewey. I can't say Abdul yet. And I think about a world where they might be attempting to come to one of the University of Minnesota campuses or enrolled or going into the workplace. And my goal is to ensure that the conversations that we're having today around the issues and challenges we face will not be the same conversations that we're having when they are enrolled at the Morris campus. So, work life. In 2015, in the middle of my PhD, sorry, 2013, in the middle of my PhD program, I did what no PhD student should do. I started a business. Put simply, I attempt to help people better connect, first with themselves and then with their teammates, their colleagues, their employees, the people that they lead. I have a series of workshops and seminars across the leadership spectrum, everything from group and team dynamics to exploring leadership models, leadership and identity, as well as bias and cultural intelligence. The work shows up in multiple ways through seminars, keynotes, long-term facilitation opportunities with big and small groups. And one of the proudest things that I wrote about in my essay questions that I won't harp on too much unless folks want to talk about is the creation and implementation of a scholarship program for students in the private colleges. That brings together the majority of my research, leadership work, and experience in a way that is impacting young people's lives every day, and one of the joys that I have. From a governance perspective, I serve on the Greater Twin Cities YMCA Board. I'm on the Board Development Committee as well as the Executive Committee of the YMCA Greater Twin Cities. Achieve Minneapolis, which is a local organization in Minneapolis attempting to get all high or Minneapolis high school students college and career ready by the time they graduate. On this board, I was the vice chair of the finance committee from 2015 to 2017. I currently chair one of the omnibus committees, the mission fulfillment committee. I've been a member of the audit committee since 2013, and I know that does not sound exciting, but if you want to know about an organization, serve on the audit committee. And I was a part of the task force that reviewed athletics culture after the resignation of former athletics director Norwood Teague. And of course, as you all know, have was fortunate to serve as the chair of the Presidential Search Advisory Committee, which landed the incoming president, Joan Gable. So as I think about how I've addressed equity and diversity goals in the leadership or governance roles, I mean, in many ways, this is what I do on a daily basis. But I'll highlight two things very quickly that I think will serve well. The two chief executive searches I've been on have been at Achieve Minneapolis, which garnered a overwhelming support for a Native American woman to serve as the CEO and president of Achieve Minneapolis, and she's been there now for about 3 years. And then, of course, the 17th president of the University of Minnesota will be our first woman president. I'll highlight one quick thing as far as this goes, again, at the University of Minnesota. Back in 2017, we were able to pass a resolution on undergraduate diversity at the Twin Cities campus in particular, and looking at how we can increase those numbers as far as recruitment, enrollment and retention, and from there we are looking to do the same thing across the other campuses. So when I think about the roles and responsibilities of the Board of Regents, I think about Regents being responsible for governance, okay? And most of us kind of theoretically know what that means, but put simply, we don't manage the university. The president and the administration manage the university. I think the challenge that people have is about what that line looks like between governance and management. As I see it, there's usually a clear line between governance and management. However, there are times, topics, and items that have a certain level of public interest that then become issues, and we as a governing board should be updated and add our input and guidance. From an individual perspective, I think about how I will know whether or not I have accomplished what I set out to do. And when I ran 6 years ago, again, I wasn't sure what I was doing or what I was getting into. And today there are times where things are thrown at us and we still haven't dealt with them even 6 years later. I'd argue that the members who have been in there for 12 years are going through things that they haven't dealt with. But yet, it's still been one of the greatest honors for me. I could mention specific things over the last 6 years, but I think instead I'll do it in a form of, here's what I hope will happen or people might say at the end of this term, and if I'm fortunate enough, at the end of another term. Put simply, and as cliche as it is, I hope that the university will be stronger than when I got here. I hope that the voiceless will feel that I offered their perspectives. I hope that I am and have been able to change the minds and hearts of some people. And I hope that I've offered a perspective that is usually not offered. And perhaps most importantly, I hope that others like me will be inspired to run for this board and know that they too can be regents. With that, I would love to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. I'll start with the first one, which is about the university's land grant mission. The University of Minnesota is obviously our state's land grant university. What does that mean to you, and what do you think it should mean to the people of Minnesota?
Yeah, so, I mean, I thank you for that. I think, first and foremost, we always have to think about the land grant mission. And we know that we were gifted the institution to serve the state, and that is what we primarily do. We do that through research, we do that through teaching, we do that for through outreach, and we do that for preparing the workforce for the future. Simultaneously, we know that we are also the research institution. We're not like a Michigan that has University of Michigan and then a Michigan State, or we can name a few other places that have the luxury of having two separate institutions, but we serve both. And so I think for us, the balance is to think about what the 21st land grant research university looks like and how we should think about it. And that to me says we do those 3 to 4 things that I just mentioned as far as focusing on the state, the research, teaching, outreach, and preparing the workforce, while simultaneously staying in the research through NIH, whether it's federal grants or National Science Foundation, and making sure that we're competing in that role as well. And as we know, we are one of the top research institutions in the country. And so while maintaining that and pushing that research out to the state, I think it's fundamental. And if we don't do it, then we're not fulfilling our mission.
Council members, Council Member Carlson.
Well, I'll just lead with a tough question because I've watched you for 6 years and been impressed. And so I'm going to ask you a tough question. I like that you led with you hope what will happen in the future. Thus, my question. At the December 12th Governance Committee meeting, there was an extensive discussion about board governance. And the things that were put up on the PowerPoint slide were improving communication between regents, formal process for disputes, Robert's Rules of Order, partisan political activity, clarification of who speaks, and removal of regents from the board. So my question to you, do you have the courage and mindset that that won't just be a one-time discussion, but you will lead some resolution of those issues?
To answer the first question, yes, I do have the courage. Secondly, I would say I would certainly be an advocate of having those deep and oftentimes challenging conversations. However, I would suggest that the chair and vice chair should be the ones leading the conversation because they chair and are the leadership of the board. However, I would certainly be one who's willing to have that conversation in a way that's going to be productive and move things forward so that we can hammer out anything or any unwielding things or unspoken dynamics of the board that need to be addressed.
Thank
you. Councilmember Menon.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today, Regent Omari. During the last 6 years, you've obviously seen a number of the crises that the University of Minnesota has faced, and I've been asking other candidates about what their philosophy is regarding crisis management, but I'd like to ask you, as a sitting member of the Board of Regents, where do you think the Board of Regents can improve on looking at crisis management?
Yeah, thank you for that question. This has been probably one, if not the most frustrating things for me as a regent and probably other board members as well. I think number one, we have to recognize two things. One, I think that there are situations that can be that we can get ahead of and keep them from turning into crises. And there are other things that are going to be crises, and we'll have to deal with them when they come because we have no idea that they're going to happen. And so, what I have been pushing for the administration to do is one, do a full 360 review of all crisis situations that we have deemed a crisis and seeing where we can learn from them. Secondly, I think it's important to be able to recognize and being thoughtful through our public relations team where we think that things could pop. And I think if we do spend enough time thinking about them, there are at least a handful of things that we can say, you know, these things might come up. Let's start to prepare for what that might look like when they come. On the end of crises when they happen and we have no way to recognize that they're going to happen or be preemptive, I would suggest that we need to have a 10 to 12, maybe even 15 point system where it outlines who we communicate with, who comes into the table. You might think of it as a situation room or a war room or what have you, so that everyone who needs to be in the loop can be in the loop. The communication can go out properly to board members, administration, so on and so forth, with a plan then to disseminate that to the rest of the university and the state as we see, including the public.
Thank you.
Councilmember Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for service, Regent Tamari. I'd like to ask a question about professional schools. I'm a graduate of the medical school, and I am aware of your recent agreement or revision of the agreement with Fairview System. But the medical school produces 80% of the practicing positions in the state, and it's a significant portion of the budget, at least the health sciences are. But yet the rankings of our medical school compared to a couple decades ago are much lower on a national basis. And I'd like your opinion or your thoughts about how do we improve those rankings, hopefully back to where we were consistently in the top 10 in the country.
Thank you. Well, you're right. They have dropped significantly. And, you know, since 1996, since we sold the hospital, we've been trying to get it back. And so we're finally at a point, and I'd actually credit this board for pushing the administration to a point of deadlines and concrete things that can mesh these two systems together. And I do think that without the agreement and the direction that we're going in, we will not increase the rankings. I fundamentally believe that we need to have a hospital, because if you look at the top institutions, they all have a hospital. And so I would suggest that with the current direction we're going in, the money flow that's going to come back from Fairview, which is, I mean, overwhelmingly higher than what it used to be, is going to allow us to hire more researchers, more practicing doctors who are also doing research. The preparation and facilities are going to allow us to recruit and enroll the top students from across the country. And we're going to continue to put out those doctors that are 80% within the state, and then maybe even send some nationally, which also will increase our ranking as we have folks going out across the nation and the world and saying, I was educated at the University of Minnesota. Another thing that obviously is going to be important as we think about bringing in the researchers is they're going to be able to bring in those research dollars, and we know that research dollars are inextricably linked to our rankings. And so those research dollars are going to continuing to come in. And I'll lastly just mention that if you haven't met Dean Jacob Toler or seen him speak somewhere or watched a YouTube video of him, you should. Because he's the type of person who has the nice balance between here's what I'm going to accomplish and here's how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to bring everybody along with me. And that's a tough balance to have when you're looking to accomplish things and be very forceful and go get it while also getting the buy-in of folks. And so I think that's the recipe that we have right now. We're going to move forward with.
Can I do just a quick follow-up?
Can you tell me why the new agreement with Fairview is going to bring in a lot more resources than the previous?
Because it's legally, the contract, number one, says that that's what's going to happen. But number two, the credit to Fairview and their new CEO, and he came from Stanford. And so he, I think, was able to recognize that we need a reciprocal relationship, one that is going to make Fairview stronger, and then one that will make the University of Minnesota stronger. And so I think between leadership and then the actual dynamics of what is legally written down, there was a recognition of the need for the resources to come back to the university, and then now we have it legally written.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Councilmember Hipsch.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Regent Omari, for joining us today. In your comments a few minutes ago with regards to land grant, you referenced the Michigan and having the kind of Michigan versus Michigan State, and commented about here in Minnesota, you have kind of both missions. Can you talk a little bit about what you've done to create partnerships with the Minnesota State system? As here in Minnesota, we have two larger higher ed systems.
Yeah, thank you. So from the perspective of being a regent, I have not done much aside from interacting with board members or presidents in different settings. From a professional standpoint, I have actually worked with the Minnesota State on an institution level basis, as well as with their overall two-year student governance organization. And so I've done some work with them about thinking of how they can do what prepare their students for the workforce and have welcoming and inclusive environments. Now, let me shift to what I think is important, and I openly admit I haven't done a lot in as far as the system, and I actually think we need to bring the private colleges into the conversation as well. So I had been thinking, if I'm not fortunate to come back as a regent, what I would love to see happen, or perhaps even take a crack at working on, is having a conversation about the system of higher education in Minnesota. Because I would actually argue that we don't have a system of higher education in Minnesota. We have the Minnesota private colleges, we have Minnesota State, and then we have the University of Minnesota. And without having that conversation about what all three of those systems look like, I think that we're doing a disservice to the state.
Thank you. Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
You mentioned that what you would do if you didn't come back as a region. What would you do if you did come back as a region to help build that vision for what higher ed should look like in Minnesota?
Yeah. So I think we have a perfect opportunity because we have a new president coming in. And we're going to have all of the folks at the table to have a conversation like that. One of the things that President-designate Gable has actually talked about, even in her private interview as well as her public interview, is the fact that we have all these complementary institutions within the state, and we're an education state, so on and so forth. And so I think that she's interested in having the conversation. I think that with some board support, obviously we would need Minnesota State to be interested, as well as the Commission of Higher Education and then the private colleges to convene. And I do believe, I'm going to blank on which task force, but I do believe that there's already been a task force who has started this conversation that might be a good opportunity to jump in there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Councilmember Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Regent Omari, for being here. And again, thank you for your service to the YMCA of the Greater Twin Cities. So you've been serving as a regent. And as you've mentioned earlier, you came into this not knowing what to expect. Can you explain what has your experience taught you? And then if you were to be reelected, how do you see your voice and leadership style changing over the next 6 years?
Yeah, thank you. So what it has taught me, so we got the rest of the day? Because you're constantly learning, right? I mean, that's what we do, and I mentioned, right, an ability or a willingness to learn. I think I've learned and honed in on my patience significantly. I have learned a lot about how you can work with folks that might not have, or that don't, quite frankly, have the same political or religious or value system as you do, but yet being able to find points of commonality while still exploring those differences and those disagreements, and either coming to a point of saying, all right, here's where we agree, let's move forward on that, or you know what, no hard feelings, we're not going to agree on this, and we can go have an adult beverage if you want to. I've learned balance. I'd say when I first joined the board, perhaps I was fortunate to be teaching a course, a graduate research assistant, being a board member, starting a business, and being a bartender at night. Perhaps those five things were good because that meant that I couldn't do all things. One example, though, was trying to negotiate our now athletics director's contract in the middle of serving drinks with the president of the University of Minnesota. And just not being able to do that, right? And I think as I move forward, my Minnesota way of attempting to remove the spotlight, if you will likely shift, because I would become one of the more senior members on the board, having served and chaired one of the largest committees on the board. So I think that would shift significantly, which would also enhance the necessity in my work, which I think I've already began, but even more so to get to know and interact significantly more with the entire board.
Vice Chair Taylor.
Abdul, nice to see you.
As always.
I had the privilege of being a part of the Regents meeting on the 12th of December when now President designate Joan Gable spent 2 hours answering 30 questions and was extremely impressive. So first of all, congratulations to you and the rest of the search committee for a job well done.
Thank you.
My impression in listening to her was that there are some important similarities between the South Carolina, I'll just use the term, academic health center system and ours. Two hospitals, two campuses. You certainly got to know her much better than we did in 2 hours. What are your impressions of what she can bring to the table to address the question that Dr. Rogers is asking? Was I reading things correctly, and that she can bring some knowledge and understanding of how this can work?
Yes, absolutely. She's been in the middle of, and if I'm not mistaken, they have the hospital and then also were merging another system at the same time. So I think she has it certainly from the academic side, the academic mission, serving as the provost, but then, of course, her legal and practical experience around contracts is going to be extremely valuable as well. And then perhaps the less technical, if you will, is that she's been at the table in those conversations and she knows how to get people on board and get folks to buy in. And I think that's going to serve her well no matter what the conversation or the topic is.
Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to, we have not met yet, so thank you for being here, Regent Omari, and your willingness to serve again. I have a question for you regarding time. Sometimes we get people of different generations here, and it looks like you have your plate full. I'm interested in knowing how do you make that work, and how much time do you spend on this? Chair McMillan told us what the expectations he thinks are. So how much time do you invest in this? And the other question, it's a twofold question. What kind of role do you play in systemic change, in oversight? And because it's talked about today, like, how do we bring, not with you, but how do we bring more revenue in? Sometimes there's systemic changes in oversight that can reshift revenue and how we spend things. And I know the university has spent a lot of time on, you know, almost $90 million of administrative costs redirected. Can you just share your role in that and how that works?
Yeah. Can I start with the second question
sure,
first?
Sure, whichever then, one then, you
so,
want.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I think of system change, I think of, number one, the actual systematic components of it, like you mentioned, whether that's policy, whether that administrative or regents policy, operations, how we operate, and then the other side of it that I think about is the hearts and minds, right? And so I don't prescribe one goes before the other, but both need to happen, right? So we could change a bunch of policy in order to have system change, but if the people aren't buying in and aren't interested in it, then enforcing those policies are going to become problematic. Flip side of that is if you change the hearts and minds and then folks say, but wait, I got to follow policy, then we're again facing these issues that we have. So most of my personal or professional work is on the people side of it, right? Now from the governance role, the way that I see it is asking the questions that are going to get people to think about how the hearts and minds need to be changed. And then from our policy level, from the region's policy level, is making sure that our policies are in line with what we want to see. And then the next level, of course, is the administrative policy. Now, administrative policy is up to the administration to change, and they have a nice process laid out where the community listens and adds input, so on and so forth, as long as they are following under our region's policy. At the same time, even though we might not be voting on administrative policy, we obviously have say in what that looks like, assuming that we're not going against what faculty, staff, students have added their input, and we're saying, no, that's not how we're going to do it. We're going to do it a different way. The other thing that I'd recognize is that the systems change takes time. And we've seen things change, whether it was affirmative consent, or policies around sexual misconduct. We've even changed some things within mental health. So we do see things happening, and I think it's this balance between how do we recognize what we've seen happen and celebrate it, while also continuing to thrive and push forward. The first question you asked, it is a lot of time. And I'd say, depending on the week, I mean, it's anywhere from 10 hours when you don't have a meeting or you're not going to an event, just keeping up, reading stuff. But when we're in meetings, between the 700 pages of preparation reading, phone calls, pre-meetings to the meetings, then the committee meetings, so on and so forth, it's any, I mean, it's 40 to 50 hours, right? I'm fortunate to not have to work 8 to 5 every day because I own a business. And so one of the only reasons why I was able to chair the Presidential Search Advisory Committee is because I have that flexibility in my schedule. I would say that I was not fortunate to spend a lot of time with my nieces and nephews during that time. However, that allows me some flexibility in that. And it is a lot of time. And then when you chair, you know, one of the major committees, time goes up. So it, but it fluctuates.
Councilmember Englund.
Regent Omari, thank you for your service and thank you for your interest in continuing to serve. And I have a question about the presidential search. And so one of the sort of unique features of a presidential search at a public university is that the search committee receives input from various constituencies, so students, faculty, alumni, financial supporters, et cetera, elected officials. Mm-hmm. So not focusing on the outcome of the search, but in the process of the search, when you led the search committee through that process of gathering input from constituents, were there things that you heard during that process that either raised your level of concern about where the constituencies thought the university was, and or were there things that you heard through that process that gave you confidence that the university is in the right direction?
Thank you. So first and foremost, I'll say I always knew this, but I had a reigniting sense of how much people care about the University of Minnesota. People really love this place. And when I first got elected, I used to say that care can come in the form of support or criticism. But either way, it's care. And when we, because Sarah Dirksen, one of our staff members, was on the road with us, when we traveled the state and went to all of the campuses, that sense of caring for the university just came straight to the forefront and all the way to the top almost immediately with our first stop in Crimson. I did not get a sense that I should be more concerned about anything than I may already be. But I will say that there were about four things that really emerged. Number one, the institution is at a point of doing great things and can go from great to even greater. And so folks have this feeling of we're there, we're right at this tipping point, and we just need someone who can, you know, just push us over that tipping point. That was number one. Number two, what I have called connectedness was something that emerged as a theme. And what I mean by that, some people call it the sense of a system. Other people call it, you know, we need to recognize all five campuses. I call it connectedness because no matter what part of the institution we went to, folks said, I want to be more a part of everything. I don't want to be over here anymore. I want to know what my colleagues are doing there. I want to know what other students are doing there. If I'm in St. Paul, I want to be a part of Minneapolis. If I'm on the West Bank, I want to be a part of the East Bank. If I'm in Crookston, I want to know what's happening at Duluth. And so this sense of connectedness was overwhelming. And the easy way to call that is system, right? We have a five-campus system, and we should treat it as a system. The third thing that was overwhelming, or that came to the fore, is folks said, we are all doing great work. We love our work. We want to be supported, and don't mess it up, right? Just support us, but don't mess it up. And that was very clear when we talked to folks. So essentially, we need your support, and we want to be a part of the system and connected, but not in a way that is going to disallow us to do what we do best. And that's the beauty of our system, is that we have five unique campuses that do different things, but yet, when we can let them do different things and excel at what they're good at, but then be the system, that's when we get to the point of pure excellence. So I'd say those are the three things that really emerged.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Councilmember Wakefield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Regent Omari, for being here today and for your service. I work in the mental health field, and I'm curious to know, from your perspective, is the U doing enough to serve the mental health needs of the students? And if not, what are the barriers and how would you address them?
Thank you. Put simply, no, we're not doing enough. We have made significant strides over the past, I'd say, 2 to 3 years. Number one, academic institutions across the country, as mental health has become more of a well-known and public conversation, they've just simply been behind, and we fell right into that category. We didn't have enough therapists. We didn't have enough space for the therapists, and we couldn't keep up. And so 2 years ago, I believe it was 2 years, during the budget meeting on the floor, an amendment was made because we had numbers about how many, and this was specific to Twin Cities, and then I'll start talking about the system campuses in a bit. We knew exactly how many full-time, half-time new counselors and therapists we needed to kill the wait time of students who are trying to get into an appointment, and made the amendment on the floor. The board voted 12-0. To pass it. We hired the folks, and we ended the wait times on the Twin Cities campus. In the last 8 months, I'd say, and this slowed down because of the presidential search, but mental health falls into the committee that I chair, the Mission Fulfillment Committee, and I've actually spent hours with each of the campus mental health folks, and that might be the chancellor involved in the conversation, or it might be Boynton, the leader of Boynton, or what have you, essentially to lay out what are the challenges, where are we falling short, what do we need to do to move forward. And what I've asked of them, without making any promises, what I asked of them, and they've all sent me, is their wish list. Here's what we need, like right now. Here's how much it's going to cost. And then if there were endless amounts of money, here's what we would really want, right? And here's how much it's going to cost. So I have a document from all five campuses that lays that out. And my goal, assuming, or I shouldn't assume, if I'm back on the board, is in the next cycle of mission fulfillment, to start having that conversation about what it looks like to reach equitable services across the system. And each campus is different and unique, so.
Chair, can I just tack on to that?
Sure.
You mentioned providing the mental health services for the students.
Yes.
How about where are we at for additional providers for the citizens of the state?
As far as preparing mental health practitioners?
Yes.
I am not sure. I wouldn't even make anything up.
Okay.
But I will add, though, that it's not just about the students either, right? Mm-hmm. Staff and faculty also have faced mental health challenges, and we need to also be thinking about those. And then simultaneously, we need to be thinking about how we train staff and faculty to recognize when a student might be in a situation that they need additional resources. We're not gonna be able to train them all to be mental health practitioners, but somebody to be able to say, I think something might be going on here. Here's where we can point you to other resources.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Regent Omari, for your service. My question has to do with enrollment. Minnesota is one of 13 states that has a negative out-migration of college-eligible students, age students. My experience watching this over the number of years as a high school principal in a large district has been that these tend to be some of our brightest students and more affluent students. The one thing we don't have a handle on is how many of them ever come back. We don't know that. We're trying to get that information. We do know that students coming to us from other states, about 30% will stay in the state. We still have a net migration loss of 7,000 to 7,500 students annually. I know the university Regents has played some games, so to speak, with the out-of-state tuition. It was once the lowest in the Big Ten, and you have a plan to raise that annually. There was some concern from the House of Representatives here in Minnesota about that issue. My question is, how concerning is that to the Board of Regents? What is the Board of Regents' plan to maybe address that? Because from a legislative standpoint, I see this as having a major impact on the workforce of the state of Minnesota for the future.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, we do have we send more students than we receive. And one of the reasons is because we're known as an education state, right? We continuously have top-performing students in K-12. And so other states and institutions come here and they set up shop and they recruit. Now, at the same time, what we need to be thinking about, one, is a large number of those students that are leaving are going to reciprocity states, particularly Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So that's an important factor to think about. Secondly, locking down on recruitment is the way that we're going to be able to keep our students, right? And part of the challenge that, or what some folks argue, and I don't necessarily buy into this argument, but what some folks argue is if a student looks at, I'll just keep picking on Michigan, the University of Michigan, and says, well, it's $40,000 or $50,000 out of state, but they're going to give me a $30,000 discount. Versus, well, the University of Minnesota is $14,000, so you're already paying less without the scholarship, right? And so is there this dynamic of saying, well, they want me so bad that they're giving me a $30,000 discount, the University of Minnesota isn't giving me a discount at all, right? So there's a way in which we have to market that and let people know that just because you're getting the discount doesn't mean that, one, you're getting a better value, and two, that they want you more or you're getting more money in the long run. Thirdly, just as far as the out-of-state conversation goes, across the system, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's 72% in-state, and about the rest are non-resident, non-reciprocity, so not Wisconsin, Manitoba, North Dakota, South Dakota. And on the Twin Cities campus, I think it's a 65 or 68, something like that. And so I see it as twofold. We need to be looking to keep the most talented in the state that we have, and we'll lose some. That's okay, because they'll go talk about how great Minnesota is, and that's perfectly fine. I'm good with that, because then folks will want to come here. Secondly, I think we need to double down on recruiting out-of-state students as well, even if only 30% are staying, because I think that's what creates a college experience that students are really looking for. They're looking for folks who come from different places and being able to interact with them across differences and finding similarities.
Final question is Councilmember Carlson.
You said that when you were on the road listening with President designee Gable, people said, don't mess it up. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming that was faculty and staff, but it might not have been. It might have been a student, too. But here's where the rubber meets the road. If you're indeed going to have the courage to have the conversation that's been unanswered for 20, 30, 40 years about the system of higher education, it is absolutely going to be disruptive. It's going to be change. It doesn't need to be destructive and dysfunctional. Do you think you yourself, coming back to the Regents, will have the courage to help lead that, whether you're in the role of chair or vice chair?
Thank you. So, again, to answer the question, yes. And I think the way that I would frame it in this conversation is actually it's not messing it up. It's enhancing and doing it in a different way, in a way that makes more sense, in a way that will serve the citizens of the state and the country better, and that will hopefully save some taxpayer dollars, too, and not that we are going to mess up what's happening, but yes, we will disrupt. And disruption is okay sometimes, as long as it's productive. And I frame it in a way that says we're not going to mess it up, we're just going to do it differently.
Okay, that concludes our questions. Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, I would make some comments, and I'll try to be quick here because I know we're at our time. The first thing that I'll just mention is that in the time that I've been a regent, we have had a lot of crises. I heard that mentioned earlier. We've had some challenges, but we've also done a lot. And I think about affirmative consent passing at the University of Minnesota, Athletes Village, mental health strides that we've taken to improve that, new buildings, renovation of existing buildings, expansions of campus, rankings continue to rise, the academic health progress with Fairview, launching a $4 billion campaign and already being $3.2 billion there, and launching a presidential search that folks said would be impossible to do. And I would venture to say that in a very biased opinion, it was a great process, and we have a great outcome, even though we won't know the full outcome for a while. And then I'll just end 100% with this. My parents come from humble means. To this day, my pop won't eat white rice because that's all he had to eat every day in Mombasa, Kenya. My mother grew up in Amman, Jordan, and her father passed away when she was 4 years old, forcing them to figure out however they could make ends meet. And for both of them, a little bit of education prowess got them visas to come to the Minnesota and attend a 2-year technical college with the idea that they would then return home and help teach English. Well, my mother married a black man, and she was disowned from her family, never to see most of her siblings or her mother again. So they settled in Minneapolis. My siblings and I grew up with hand-me-downs and watching when my mother would pretend that she was waiting for everyone else to eat before getting her own plate. But one day, realizing that she was waiting to make sure that there was enough food because one of our friends just happened to be over around dinner time, sacrificing her own meal. We never had a car over $500. We went to the police auctions and bought the ones that were beat up. But just like for my parents, my siblings, and me, education gave a different opportunity. And perhaps my parents didn't capitalize as much as my siblings and me, one owning a small disc jockey company and my mother being a server at Denny's for the most of our lives. But education was the opportunity. And I want to serve this institution in this state because I believe that quality and equitable education can be the equalizer for every person in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Regional.